Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. Each week we visit with veterans, mostly of the World War II generation, men and women who were willing to put their lives on the line for our freedom. And the idea is to honor them for their service and their sacrifice, to preserve their stories for posterity, and along the way, learn a thing or two about how to love your country. And that's what we're going to do today with 94-year-old Paul Bogosian of Fresno, California. He served with the 330th Bomb Group in the Pacific during World War II, more specifically the 458th Squadron, which actually lost its commanding officer on its very first mission. The 330th Bomb Group flew its first mission from Guam's North Field on April 12, 1945. And if you were alive in 1945, you might remember that date, a significant date to all Americans at the time. April 12, 1945 was the day President Franklin D. Roosevelt died. I'll ask Paul Bogosian about that, but first a little more background on the distinguished unit with which he served. Of all the bomb groups in the 20th Air Force, those big B-29 super fortresses of the 330th Bomb Group had the highest over-the-target rate and the lowest overall rate of having to abort missions. The group flew its last combat missions the day the war officially ended with the Japanese surrender. We'll talk to Paul about the 21 missions that he flew, some in the daytime, many at night, flying from Guam to Japan and bombing airfields, aircraft factories, chemical plants, oil refineries, just about any industrial target in any major Japanese city. On one mission, the 330th even dropped bombs within range of Emperor Hirohito's palace, which was one building they were not supposed to hit. The son of one 330th Bomb Group pilot has put together an impressively thorough website documenting the group's planes, personnel, and missions, complete with some terrific photos. And you'll even find our guest Paul Bogosian's name on that website. I have it linked from our site at kmjnow.com. Go there or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page to learn more. And let's get to the interview now with 94-year-old Paul Bogosian of Fresno, California, originally from Massachusetts. And I guess that's probably where you were on December 7th, 1941. What do you remember about that day?
I was in Andover, Massachusetts, and I lived there, and I was about 27 years old, I think. I remember the war started. I was working in Vermont. I had come home that day to visit my family. It's terrible. It was very unhappy, but something that happened and we had to face it.
Was it a big shock to you to hear that Pearl Harbor had been bombed?
Yes, it was a big shock. I can remember I went down up to town Andover and talked to some of the people, and everybody was shaken up real bad.
And did it occur to you that maybe this is something that was going to impact you directly?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, because I was born here in the United States, and my parents were born in Armenian Turkey, and I was happy they moved here, and I was a native of the United States, born here, and I was happy as the Dickens as I was an American citizen.
And I'm sure that you had heard stories about World War One, because you were a couple years old when World War One was happening. You heard a lot of stories about what was done to the Armenians just before that, I'm sure. Did some of that come up when you thought about what might be happening in the world now? I mean, did that impact your feeling of duty or your desire to do something about it?
Yes, I wanted to do something. I wanted to get into service. I wanted to do something about it. I had a defense job, and they wouldn't take me. I had to quit my defense job to get into service. Jones & Lanza Machine Tool Company. I worked there 3 years and some months, and I quit to get drafted. They wouldn't draft me. I went to the draft board and asked them to draft me in Andover and in Springfield, Vermont, and they wouldn't take me.
So they wouldn't draft you because you were already working at a defense tool plant. Why did you want to be drafted so bad? Why did you want to be in the service so bad?
Well, my boy was 4F. He had bad legs. He had hurt his legs when he was a youth, and he was 4F. They wouldn't take him in the service. And they put me down as a defense worker. Well, I didn't want that.
So how did you end up in the Army Air Corps?
Well, because I wanted to be a flyer. I wanted to get promoted. I wanted to do something that was new. It was encouraging. It was ambitious to get in there.
Did you, when you joined the Army Air Corps, Were you hoping that you might become a pilot yourself?
No, I didn't want to be a pilot. I wanted to be a navigator.
Where did that come from? What made you want to do that?
Well, I didn't think I had the qualifications for a pilot. I didn't think I was that brave.
I think you found out eventually it didn't matter how brave you were. You were all in it together on an 11-man bomber crew, huh?
That's right. Absolutely right.
So eventually you were trained as a navigator, as a bombardier, as a radar operator. Yeah. What was all that training like, and what would you say was the most challenging for you?
Well, it was easy for me because I was pretty well educated. I was pretty well intelligent, and I took it pretty well. I learned it easily. My mathematics was good. I was good at mathematics and engineering, and my brain was working good. I'm 94, 95 years old. My brain still works good.
And you're going to prove it to us over the course of this program, I know. Was it as easy as it was for you, as you're sharing with us, that it wasn't that challenging for you to learn what you needed to learn? Were you getting a little antsy through all that training and wishing that you would get assigned to some missions pretty soon?
Oh, yes. I was very fast. I was in service only barely over two years. And in 9 months, I was overseas, flying missions. Mm-hmm. 9 months. That's short notice. And I didn't think, I never thought I was going to get back. I was the only one in the crew that didn't know how to swim. I didn't tell any of the crew members I didn't know how to swim. I told them that bombardier Art Talbot from New Jersey, he was my closest friend. I told him, I said, Art, I don't know how to swim. I told the enlisted men too, and the enlisted men thought I was teasing them. I couldn't get them to believe me. I said, I can't swim. I'm telling you the truth. Oh, he says, you're kidding. No, he says, I'm not kidding. I can't swim. I tried to learn. I can't learn. I'm scared of water. The minute I hit water, I just forget everything.
And so the fact that they sent you to the Pacific was probably the worst place for you to go, knowing how much you'd be flying over water and what the chances of being shot down or having a ditch might be.
You bet. That was the worst place I could go. Worst place I could go. Right over the ocean all the time. Every mission was over the ocean. I was scared as hell. I never looked out of the windows. I sat in a chair in a dark room, and I stayed there all the time. Once in a while, I would walk out, and I'd barely peek out the side window and come back and sit down and just kind of shake.
Well, let's talk about what your duties were, and let's talk about the plane that you were on, because at that time, the B-29 was the biggest one America had. Do you remember the first time that you ended up in a B-29 and what your first impressions of that big plane were?
Oh, boy, what a flying plane that was. That was the best plane. That was the best, most terrific plane in the world, I'll tell you that. And the men that designed that plane and the man that made that plane, I give them credit for our missions. We flew 20 missions, 21 missions, and I don't know how that we ever did it. We left the airport, and we'd be over water all the time for 24, 25, 26 hours. And most of the time, we lost an engine all the time. And never took off and came back with four engines working. Sometimes we had two engines working, and that plane still kept on going. It kept on going. It kept on going. It kept on going and going and going and going. I don't know how they did it. The men that designed that plane and the men that worked on it and the men that built it were just wonderful. That was the best thing the United States government and people ever did for the war.
So you were impressed with the durability of a B-29.
It was tremendous. It was tremendous.
Well, I want to hear, before we're done, about some of the damage that was done to that plane and all the missions you flew on it. But let's talk about what your role was on that 11-man B-29 crew. You talked about sitting in a dark room in the back of the plane. There was a reason for that. Tell us what your position was and what you would be doing on a typical mission.
I ran the radar equipment. I did the night work on the mission. Daytime, we could see what we were doing, but nighttime, nobody knew what was going on except myself. And that radar was terrific. It was a new invention. It was something new. No other country had it. I think the English developed it first and gave it to the United States. The United States perfected it, and perfected it they did. It was terrific. Unbelievable. I wanted to get into service because my brother was 4F. He had a bad leg. And when I volunteered to get into service, I quit my job and I made him draft me, 1A, and I got into service, and that's the best thing in my life I ever did.
Tell me about how that radar equipment worked. You're sitting there, and what do you see, and how do you know what information to relay to the pilot and to the crew up front?
Well, it was very clear. I was in a dark room, and we got the pictures of the site, and it showed very clearly what it was. Everything was just like looking at a motion picture. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Terrific.
So you could see the outline of the land.
See the land, and you could see the people. Everything as clear as could be.
So then was it your responsibility to relay that to the front of the plane and let them know when you're approaching the target or over the target?
Well, I would contact them and tell them what we were doing and how we were approaching the target and how close we were and when I was going to drop the bomb. I would tell them bombs away, when the bombs went away, and that was it. It was very successful. We had 21 successful missions. Everyone was a success. We never diverted from our target. Every time we started out, if we had a bad engine or something, most of the time we flew on three engines. A lot of time we had trouble. And we flew over water most of the time, and I was the only one in the crew that couldn't swim.
Tell me about your plane. I found something on the computer that talked about your crew, and it said that your primary plane for your crew was called the City of Glens Falls, New Jersey. Is that what you remember?
Yes, that's right. That was named after the bombardier's hometown.
Talbot?
Talbot, yeah. Well, he was a nice guy, a very friendly guy. We were very close friends. I lost contact with him a couple of years back. I don't know what happened. I don't know whether he died or what happened. I don't know what happened, but he was my best friend. We were very, very close. His wife was a doll.
Shed some light on that for us in terms of naming the plane. So you guys get this brand new B-29. Why did the bombardier get to pick the name of it?
Well, I had the first pick, but I had my pick was already been chosen by somebody else. So he had the second pick. Talbot had the second pick, and he's chosen the city of New Jersey, I think was one of
the... Yeah, the city of Glens Falls, and apparently in your bomb group, in the 330th bomb group, most of the planes bore the name of one city or another, from what I've read, and that was City of Glens Falls, New Jersey. So you said that you had the first pick and it was already taken, so I'm sure all our audience wants to know, what would you have chosen?
Andover, Mass., Lawrence, Mass. I was born in Lawrence and Andover, but they said that was too small a city to be named after a target, after a plane. Nobody knew about Andover.
They would have if it was on your plane. You could have put it on the map, to be sure. And I also read that plane had the nickname of the old cue ball. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, that we had a cue ball. We found that cue ball.
Was there a cue ball painted on the nose or something?
Yes, it was painted on the nose. We went and picked it up at the party or something. We picked it up someplace on a trip, the bombardier and I, and we brought it back. And that became my mascot.
An actual cue ball from a pool set. That was your mascot for your crew.
Yes, it was.
So that plane, and that's you flew that for all 21 missions, or at least most of them?
We flew it on all 21 missions. It was a good plane. We lost an engine on every mission. Every mission, we flew three engines, but we came back.
Yes, you did. All 21 missions, thanks to your pilot, Clyde Higginson, and your co-pilot, of course. You did come back, and when we come back with more Hometown Heroes, we're going to hear more about some of those missions and about the most terrifying moments Paul experienced in that B-29. Paul Boghossian, 94 years old, of Fresno, California, is our guest today. We'll be back with more Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ. Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while. So next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
course, is Wild Blue Yonder, in honor of our guest today, Paul Bogosian, a 94-year-old World War II veteran of the Army Air Corps. Wild Blue Yonder performed there as expertly as ever by the Sounds of Freedom. And while I'm talking about it, I want to thank all of you who came out to the Warner Center for the Performing Arts last week to see the Sounds of Freedom in concert. It's always a treat to share the stage with those talented and dedicated musicians. And mixing in some terrific trumpet solos from Tim McFarland, having Richard Sensabaugh on that one-of-a-kind 83-year-old organ at Warner's Theater made it a truly unique experience. The best part about the concert, though, was that it raised money to help men and women returning from overseas military duty. And on this Memorial Day weekend, we want to remember all those we've lost, but also keep in mind those who have been willing to give all and might need to receive some help from us at this time. On this day 66 years ago, our guest Paul Bogosian and his fellow flyers had just completed the last major strike of the war on Tokyo proper, an incendiary raid that damaged or destroyed 31 different industrial targets. And speaking of damage, before we had to step away there, you heard Mr. Bogosian mention that it seemed like almost every mission included the loss of at least one engine on that four-engine superfortress. So put me in your shoes. If you're in the back of the plane, you're at your radar observation station, and you hear over the intercom, we've got an engine down, we've got two engines down, we've been hit. When those kinds of things happen, what goes through your mind? What are you thinking back there?
We're going to make it back. We're going to make it back. God's with us. We're going to make it back.
You talk about God being with you. Are you back there praying? Do you have time to do something like that?
Well, you find a second to pray here and there. Here and there, that's about all.
And I don't mean to make light of it. I mean, it sounds to me like you were pretty sincere and pretty serious about praying for some help because there was a pretty good possibility you might not make it back.
Well, I was the only one in the crew that couldn't swim. I was scared hell of the water. I never looked out the window, believe it or not. I never looked out. Once, after about the 20th mission, I looked out the window and I got scared as a dickens.
Tell me about some of the targets that you guys were assigned to hit, and how would you know when you got there?
Well, we looked at the map and looked at the pictures and sites around there, picked up certain targets we wanted, certain spots we wanted designated. We looked at it, we identified it by the little spots they told us to look for. And it was easy to find the targets there because it was a very ocean-like area, and most of the targets we hit were right off the ocean. And they were lucky. We were lucky. We were very fortunate.
You guys were based on Guam. You talked about these long missions. Explain for us where those missions were go. You're going a pretty far away from Guam, right?
Yes, we were quite a ways. It was 24 to 26 hours all the time. We used to fly over the water. We leave the island, fly over water, and then hit Japan, and that was it.
So you're flying all the way to mainland Japan, and that's where your targets were?
Mm-hmm.
And this was in the spring of 1945 and from there on out?
Yes, uh-huh.
Were you getting any kind of reports of how successful your missions may or may not be?
Well, I was getting letters from back home from my brother and sister, and they were very helpful to me. They maybe encouraged me. We didn't get any newspapers where we were in Guam, you know, and we didn't know what was going on too much. But my folks, my brother and sister told me what was going on, and they were happy about it.
How did you know whether, when you guys went on a bombing run and you dropped all your bombs and you came back, how would you know whether or not you had been successful in your target?
Well, you see, I was on radar. See, I had the radar equipment, and I also had a outside window by my seat so I could see both of them. And I very seldom get out to the table where I could still look out the window, but I looked at the vision, and I could see clearly what was happening all the time. I had a clear view that we were successful.
And being stationed on Guam, what was that like? Because obviously you're not spending every moment of every day flying a bombing mission. What would you guys do on your downtime? And what was life on Guam like in the spring of 1945?
Life was wonderful. It was away from home, no parents around, nobody we knew around, no women around. But, you know, it was a wonderful island to be on, wonderful island, and the service was good. The food was good. The headquarters were good. You couldn't ask for anything better.
and you felt like the native inhabitants of Guam were glad to have you there?
We didn't have anything to do with the natives at all. Nothing at all to do. We were told to stay away from them.
What'd you guys do for fun?
Nothing. Just talk to each other. We compare. My best friend was Art Talbot. He was from New Jersey. He was a bombardier, and I was a navigator bombardier, night bombardier. And we got along good together. His wife was a very wonderful person. He had a son, and they accepted me very well, and I accepted them very well. We were very friendly with one another, and we were left overseas. My memories of them was always with me.
A lot of things happened while you were over there in the Pacific, and I think probably one of the first things after you guys started flying there, in April of 1945, President Roosevelt died. Do you remember where you were when that happened, and how did that news strike you?
It was a death blow. It was a dead bad blow. I remember we sat down, we talked, and everybody just looked at one another. We didn't say a word for about a couple of minutes, 2 or 3 minutes, and finally we started talking to one another. We were devastated, absolutely devastated.
Why do you think it hurt that much? What did he do that made him have such a personal connection to all of you?
Well, he was an invalid to start off with. And he was a nice man. He was a very nice, conscientious president. He had his heart and soul was into the work. And it was during wartime. And he loved the people, and the people loved him. You know, when war comes up, the people of the United States get together. We put everything else aside. We get together, we stick together. We're for our country. We are the most wonderful country in the whole world. I know. My father lived in Armenian Turkey, and the mistreatment he got. And the way he talked about his life over there, and he was so glad to be in the States. And I was glad to be that he was my father and that he brought me to the States. And my father gave birth to me in the States. I think this is the greatest country a person can live in and be born in. There's nothing like it. I've been all over the world myself. My wife and I traveled in Europe. We've gone a lot, and there's nothing like the United States. The people here are wonderful.
In terms of the death of Roosevelt, you talk about it hitting you really hard. Did you feel like it gave you even more motivation, strengthened your resolve to finish the job that he had started with that speech the day after America was attacked?
Absolutely. It made us increase our efforts, put more push in our. We put it in 100%. We put in 200% after that. We wanted to win the war.
And you would. And you talked about all 21 of your missions. You were able to come back in that B-29 and how thankful you were for that. I'm curious, what was the closest call that you remember? What was the time where you were most afraid that you might not come back from this mission, or you might end up in the water and everyone would know you couldn't swim and you might have to be rescued? Or what do you remember being the most terrifying moment that you experienced?
I don't know what happened. It was an earlier flight. Something happened. We lost a couple engines. We lost one engine, then we lost another engine. We're flying on two engines for about an hour or so, and I had given all up hope, and I said my last prayer. And it was hard. We made it.
I'm sorry. I know it's not easy to talk about stuff like that, but as I understand what you're saying, you guys all were prepared to have to bail out of that airplane.
I couldn't swim. I told the bombardier, I told the enlisted men, my enlisted men were my best friends, you know. I told them, I said, please, I can't swim. Will you help me? And they looked at me and they thought I was kidding all the time. They wouldn't believe me.
So in this instance, your worst fears are materializing in front of your face, and you say what you believed would be your last prayer. This is it. We're either going in or we might make it by the skin of our teeth. What do you remember about actually getting that plane on the ground and how good it felt to walk off of it?
Oh, boy. We were sitting in the back of the plane, all of us. I was the only officer back there. With the enlisted men, my office was in the back of the plane, my position, and I had the 3 or 4 enlisted men with me back there, and they were my best friends, and we just sat down there, and we just looked at one another. We didn't talk at all, and when the man said we're going to land now, we couldn't believe it. It was impossible to believe. It was the happiest moment of my life. I believe that right again, the happiest moment of my life.
And So did your pilot, Higginson, did he get some pats on the back after that?
Oh, boy. We get out there, and he was loaded with water. His sweat was perspiring all over his body. He was dripping over. He was soaking wet, absolutely. Soaking wet, soft water all over him. And I always remember that, But he was a first-class pilot. He looked after the crew.
What do you think made the difference? If you guys were so sure that you might not make it, if you're running on only two engines on this gigantic four-engine plane, was it pilot skill? Was it answers to prayer? Was it a combination of both? What do you think made you guys actually bring that plane in and survive?
Combination of everything. We had a good crew. We all worked together. We were working for one another. We were working for the United States government. We were working for our country. That's the main thing. We all had our country in our mind. Nobody had any other intention in mind but for our country to win the war and go home and be with our family. We knew we were going to get home.
When you go through something like that mission, I think as people, there's two ways that some of us might handle it. Some of us might say, wow, that was horrible. That's going to happen to me again. Or some people might say, wow, we got it through that. I think we can make it through anything now. How did it affect you guys as a crew?
The last one you said, we can make it through everything. We knew if we made it through the last that mission there, we'd make it through any mission. We went through everything. We were giving up hope almost, and we made it. And we wanted to see our family. We wanted to see our loved ones again. That's what the main thing was. We had our mothers and fathers and children, brothers in our mind all the time. I'm going to say children. We weren't married. We didn't.
Not yet.
The bombardier was married, and the pilot was married, but the rest of us were all single.
And you would have been single forever if you didn't make it home. Well, I asked you about when Roosevelt died. There are a few other significant days that occurred while you were over there in the Pacific. And I'm curious, you're in a bomb group, you have this high-tech, top-secret radar equipment, and that's a question I wanted to ask you, too. Did you have specific instructions with regard to that radar equipment? Should you guys have to ditch or the plane was going to crash, did you have any instructions to disable that radar equipment so the Japanese wouldn't discover it, or was it not that secret of a situation?
Well, we didn't think about that. We knew we were going to make it back. We knew that plane was going to take us back. That B-29 was a wonderful plane.
I'm curious. So here you are in a bomb group. You've flown all these missions. Had you heard anything, any kind of buzz, any kind of rumor, any kind of speculation that there was some top-secret weapon the United States was developing that was going to end the war, that was going to bring the war to a close and save lives and shorten the war? Or was the atomic bomb as big of a surprise to you as everybody else?
That was the biggest surprise in the world. We never heard a word about it. Nobody ever told us one single thing. Never anticipated anything like it. It was a happy moment in our lives. Everybody was so happy we had something like that.
How did you find out about it?
Well, we heard on the radio overseas. We had some good news overseas all the time. They kept us informed. That was one good thing they did. They kept us informed.
Except for Tokyo Rose, huh?
We listened to her once in a while, too. We liked to listen to her because she was good to listen to. She's a lot of BS, but we listened to her.
Would you get a laugh out of her, or did she upset you?
No, we laughed at what she said. We laughed. We really ridiculed her.
Now, I've heard some guys say that she even mentioned, a lot of times, Navy guys will say that she mentioned their ships by name, and some guys even said she mentioned some planes by name.
Oh, yeah, she had all the names, and all the names. I don't know how she got them. She had them all.
And it was a source of entertainment for you?
Oh, yes, it was fun. We giggled about it.
Now, speaking of entertainment, I've seen pictures and film and read stories about some of the entertainers who made their way through the Pacific during that time. Did you guys ever have any special guests on Guam while you were there?
We had some come in there, but I forget who they were now. We used to go to all those things there. They used to, matter of fact, they used to come from all over the island there to come north. It was good because we met people that were... I met people I work with that way. They came to listen to some of the people that came over to our area to talk.
So people you knew from back in the States?
Yes, the people I work with. I was happy to see them. That's the only time I never get to see them since then.
Your wife tells me you saw Carol Landis and Bob Hope perform on Guam. Carol Landis, the striking blonde, I guess would be one way to describe her, she is said to have visited more troops during World War II than any other actress And I'm guessing she was probably pretty popular there on Guam in 1945.
Oh, boy, I'll say she was. I felt like hugging her, but I couldn't get this close to her.
But you had a story to tell anyway, huh?
Yeah. She's a wonderful person. She spent a lot of time with us, and she was very warm with us, too. She's very mixing with all us fellas and everything else. Bob Hope, too. They were wonderful. They were wonderful. They came there and spent all that time there with us. Very wonderful. Warm, friendly. And they could tell they were talking from their heart. They just didn't come out there just to say hello to us and get the hell out of there and go home. They were spending how they shook hands with us and hugged us. And they just made us feel like we were one of them.
And, you know, obviously they were doing that to try to boost morale. Did you feel like visits like that did have an effect on your...
Sure, that has a big effect on you, big effect. The fact that they came over there and they were interested in us. Gee, you know, we're in an island where nobody else would want to come visit there. Why would anybody want to be there? Why would anybody want to come to that island? There's nothing there. There's nothing there. Beautiful island. The weather was terrific. It was better weather than any place else we'd ever been. Wonderful weather. I'd like to be there now. But
you got a Fresno a summer ahead of you, my friend. I'm sorry.
Well, no, Fresno is the best place in the world. I'm from back east, and I love Fresno. This is the best place in the world to be. Believe me.
Well, I want to ask you about how you ended up here, but let's talk a little more about the end of the war. So you said it was wonderful news to hear about the use of the atomic bomb. How soon after that were you able to head back home?
Just about immediately, I would say. It was a short time. It was so fast. I can't believe the government acted so fast to get us troops back home. It's wonderful what the United States government did to us troops. It's wonderful the way they treated us, especially in the Air Force. Now, I was in the Air Force, see, so we got over there fast. I was in the service 6 to 8 months, and bingo, I was overseas, and I spent 8 months, 9 months, 10 months overseas, and when I came back fast. The war was over. They shipped us over. We flew our plane over and crew, and we were back home with our family. And
I want to hear about that, as I'm sure our audience does, but we need to step aside for just a few moments. We will be back with Paul Bogosian and the rest of Hometown Heroes right after this on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I am Paul Leffler, and remember, if there's a hero in your hometown that you want to let me know about, you can email me, paul@kmjnow.com. That's paul@kmjnow.com. Don't forget to follow the program on Facebook as well. Just type in Hometown Heroes, and it'll pop right up. We want to continue our visit now with 94-year-old Paul Bogosian of Fresno. I'm sure you've gotten a taste already for his passion, his love for our country. He served as a navigator, bombardier, and radar observer on a B-29 Super Fortress with the 330th Bomb Group during World War II. And before we took that break, he was telling us about how quickly he was able to come back home to the USA after the war in the Pacific ended. And you decided to make that a bit of a surprise for your family, I understand. What do you remember about that reunion with your loved ones?
One Sunday night, I landed and up north and took train down home, and next day, I think it was a day or two afterwards, I didn't tell my folks anything about it, and they were sitting down talking with my aunt and their family, and they were all talking about whose boys was going to get home first, and I walked in on them at 7 o'clock at night, Sunday night.
Surprise!
Surprise! And how?
And something tells me you can probably still remember the expression on your mother's face.
I can still remember the expression in their face, and I can remember my expression, too. It was wonderful. Wonderful. And my aunt and them were there, and they were all shocked to see me walk in because I hadn't told them anything about it.
How did you transition back to being a civilian after your time in the Air Corps and hanging out with the guys all the time and never having women around and all of that? How did you transition back into quote-unquote normal life?
I'll tell you, it was very simple, very simple. Very easy. No problem at all. I didn't go wild. I didn't go crazy. I faced it very well.
And how'd you end up in Fresno?
Well, my aunt was in Fresno and lived here. My mother had come and visited here with my sister, and they came back east and bragged about the weather and the people. And so I said, boy, I want to go back. I want to go over there and see them. I want to move to California myself.
So you didn't wait too long to come out here then, huh?
Well, I was in the service after that, see, and I came back in, and after the service, I came to California. And it's the best thing I ever did.
Well, I guess so, because if you hadn't, you never would have met your wonderful wife, Hiran. And I want to get that story, but first, something that seems relevant to share. Even though you clearly had no trouble re-assimilating to American culture after your time overseas, I found this when researching your bomb group, the 330th Bomb Group, and I thought our audience would get a kick out of it. Apparently, this little note was given to all of you as you prepared to head home from that duty with the 330th overseas. And it reads like this: instructions to soldiers returning to the United States. Communique. In view of the fact that some of the personnel now overseas will be forced to accept an assignment in the U.S., we are printing this short practical guide on that foreign country. A. The United States is composed of land bisected in the center by the Mississippi River. Everything east of the river is known as New York, and everything west of the river is known as Texas. There are a couple of other states that have been admitted to the Union, but they are not important. B. Americans have the disgusting habit of bathing twice a week. Care should be taken when stepping into the shower, as hot water is common. Stay away from same, as people have been known to turn white from using it too frequently. C. Food is generally plentiful, but in some localities, powdered eggs are almost impossible to obtain. You will probably be forced to eat the shell-covered kind on most occasions. Remember, do not eat the shell. Simply crack the egg and toss the covering away. D. Dehydrated vegetables are almost extinct in the United States. Stores feature spinach, carrots, potatoes, and turnips in their raw and natural state. You will probably notice pieces of soil still clinging to these items. Wash them before eating. And these instructions to soldiers returning to the United States continue with point E. In many restaurants, you will see an item called steak on the menu. This dish is to be eaten with a knife and fork. Do not attempt to tear it to pieces with your fingers. Steak has a meaty taste and isn't too revolting after one gets used to it. Of course, it doesn't come up to the luscious delectability of our own Spam. F. One should be cautious when ordering drinks in bars or saloons. Bartenders will try to sell aged stocks of bourbon and scotch. Do not be taken in by such practices. Some of the whiskey is 50 years old and is obviously spoiled. And G. The final point on these instructions to soldiers returning after World War II. Point G. The country is run by Democrats, Republicans, and Frank Sinatra. It is a big place stretching all the way across the country. Keep on your toes, however, and you will get along all right. And in your case, Paul, clearly you did get along all right. And after ending up in Fresno, you found that special someone, a younger woman. You're 94 now, but she's only 89, and she's going strong. Her bountiful vegetable garden she takes such good care of keeps her busy. And I know that your granddaughter Claire is putting together a report on you for one of her class projects at Bullard High. She even shared some of those photos with me. I've loaded them up on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page and on our website, kmjnow.com. So if you're listening out there and you want to see Paul and Hiran as newlyweds and what they look like today as well, go online, kmjnow.com, or that Facebook page for Hometown Heroes. But let's get the story now, Paul. How did you meet your wife?
I met her at a party that night, and I liked her, and she liked me, and we got together, and we hooked up, and we got together, and we got married. Mm-hmm. It was a wonderful marriage. I've enjoyed it. We've had four children. We get along fine. We don't argue with each other. We don't say any cross words to one another or anything. I love her, and she loves me.
Well, I bring it up only because everything that we've been talking about, everything that you experienced in the war, the days that you thought, this is it, we're not going to make it back. And when you think about that in terms of your family, you never would have met your wife, your kids would have never been born. What do you think about when that pops into your mind?
I frankly don't think about it. I want to stay away from that thought. I want to make sure that I thought I was going to get back all the time. I think the Lord was with me. I don't know why, but the Lord was with me. He was helping me out. I think he was on our side.
When you think back of that time in your life, what are you the most thankful for, and what are you the most proud of?
I'm an American citizen. I was born in the United States. My father came to the United States. My mother came to the United States, and they stayed here. And we got married and gave birth to four children and we really enjoyed it. This is the best country in the world. I've been to Europe and Asia, and I'll tell you, this is the best place in the world to be. Best place, the absolutely best place. There's nothing else like the United States. I started with nothing, and look here, look where I'm living now. We moved from back east from Massachusetts to California. Look at my house. My father was a mill worker. I went to high school. I started college. I had a nervous breakdown. I couldn't complete. And yet I worked, and look what I am now.
And you're not done yet. You're not even 95 yet. You got a few more months before you hit that.
I'm going to hit over 100.
I'm going to hold you to that.
Well, I hope so. You're going to be around when I'm in there. We'll go out to dinner together, okay?
Deal. Now, I got to ask you, I understand your granddaughter has been working on something about your time in the war for her high school project at Bullard High School. And I'm curious, when you talk to your grandkids and they say, tell me about World War II. What were you guys doing there? What was it all about? What's the most important message that you try to share with her?
We made it back. That's what counts. We made it back because God loved us. We were fighting for a just cause. United States is a just country. It's the best country in the world to live in. You got the best opportunity, the best chance to make something. You got a chance to make something out of your life regardless of who you are. Regardless of where you were born, regardless of what your name is. You can be any name you want. I mean your name, any Jewish name, any name in the world. Go as far as you want to go. I went as far as I wanted to go. I didn't want to go any farther than that. I wanted to be president of the United States. I couldn't be president of the United States. Anybody could be president of the United States. This is the only country in the world where a person is born and he has an opportunity to be president of the United States, the country he's born in, regardless of what nationality, what religion, or anything, or what his beliefs are. He has an opportunity here to obtain the highest position in the government, and that you can't do that in any other country.
Oh, amen. And what you guys did in World War II went a long way toward keeping it that way. I want to ask you, too, you know, it's interesting for our listeners to hear about the intense experiences in war and the close calls and the moments where you didn't know if you were going to make it. But I think people also enjoy kind of the chance circumstances or the lighthearted stories. And I don't know if this would qualify as lighthearted or not, but I understand that there was an admiral or a high-ranking naval officer who had you in his crosshairs because he thought you made a big boo-boo on a bombing run and almost blew up his ship. What do you remember about that?
We get blamed for it. And I tried to explain to him that we didn't do it. I don't think I had anything to do with it. That's the worst part of it.
Well, that sounds scarier than having enemy planes shoot you down as being potentially court-martialed for something you didn't do.
Yes, I didn't have anything to do with it.
So your crew was being blamed for the actions of another crew. It was another plane that nearly bombed the admiral's ship. So they hadn't actually flown their mission or gone through with it, but they still had their bombs when they came back, and they had to get rid of them somewhere.
Yes, and they had to get rid of them. Our pilot would never do anything like that. Instead, the crew was trying to get away with murder, and our pilot was a honest man. He would never do anything like that. He was a very Christian man. He would never do anything wrong.
I guess that doesn't really qualify as a lighthearted story, but were there any funny moments that occurred within your crew or moments that if you would talk to Talbot after the war that you guys would joke about or laugh about?
No, I don't think so. Everything was serious. Yeah. It was serious all the way through. War was a terrible thing to get into, but we were going to make the best of it we could.
What did your friends used to call you on that crew? Because, I mean, you guys all have nicknames for each other. You refer to each other a certain way. What did they call you?
Bogo. I was Bogo. B-O-G-O, Bogo.
Did you like that?
Oh, that's okay. That's okay. We had a good crew. We had nice fellas on our crew. I was back. I was the only officer with the enlisted men in the back part of the plane. And the enlisted men were my best friends. They became my best friends.
Now, you mentioned something about there being no prejudice, and it doesn't matter what your name is, whether you're Armenian, whether you're Jewish, that you could get a chance in America. Were you ever concerned in the service that because maybe there weren't as many Armenians around you, that you were the only Armenian on your crew, that you would be persecuted?
No. I never met an Armenian in the Air Force. I never met another one. Never met another flyer. They didn't even know what an Armenian was.
When you moved to Fresno, I've heard stories of some Armenian families changing their name so they didn't sound Armenian. Was that ever something you thought about?
No, never. I always accepted that. I never had any trouble at all. Mm-hmm. Never.
A lot of times I'll talk to a veteran, and it's easier to talk about what someone else did than something you did yourself. And I'm curious if you ever saw one of your fellow crew members or someone from another plane or anything like that, that they did something that you thought was really special or really courageous or really brave, and it made you proud to be on the same side of things as them. Do you remember anything like that, that something really stuck with you, the actions of one of your fellow servicemen?
No, I just remember that all our crew members were all cooperative, 100%. We never had a single argument on our crew. Never, never. Not one bad word was said about anybody else. We loved each other. We were hoping to hold each other together.
Was there anything scarier or more treacherous about flying at night than during the daytime, or did you grow to appreciate flying at night?
Well, it didn't make any difference. That plane was a good plane. That B-29 was a wonderful plane.
Have you ever gotten in arguments with B-24 or B-17 guys over whose plane was better?
No. We had the best plane in the world. We had a wonderful life in the service. I can't complain about it at all. Some people complain about their life in the service. I got nothing to complain about. And when you serve your country and you're treated the way they treated us, you can't complain.
Well, you don't strike me as much of a complainer anyway. Thank you, Paul, for serving our country and for sharing with us today a little taste of that intense love for your country that you clearly still have today. That is Paul Bogosian, 94 years old, and you heard him say he plans on making it to 100, so I look forward to celebrating that with him. Don't forget to learn more about Paul and his 330th Bomb Group by going to our website, kmjnow.com. I want to thank John Kalashian for letting me know about Paul and his story, and I want to encourage you, if you're listening, to find a way to make this Memorial Day weekend more meaningful than maybe it has been for you in the past. It's easy to just think of it as a barbecue or a picnic. But look in the paper, look online for events in your area, whether it's something in the Fresno area, that moving Memorial Day tribute in Manteca that's getting bigger and bigger every year, thanks to the efforts of Pastor Mike Dillman there. Or it could even be as simple as visiting your local cemetery or just spending time reflecting on family members or friends that you remember as people who were willing to risk everything they had for the sake of freedom. It's so easy to take that freedom for granted, but we must never forget the great price that has been paid. That's what this show is all about, and I don't think you'll be mad at me for emphasizing that in honor of Memorial Day. I hope you'll agree that it's fitting to close this week's program by quoting from the Gospel of John, chapter 15, verse 13. Greater love has no one than this, that he laid down his life for his friends. And as Americans, we have so many friends who have done just that for us, more than 400,000 of them in World War II alone, and more recently, many from right here in Central California. Let us reflect on that throughout the weekend, and let's meet up again next Saturday for another edition of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.